Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Hoovering, the podcast about eating. I'm Jessica Fostercue. I love eating as much as anything else in the world, but also it sometimes brings me conflict, shame, and all sorts of other things that are rubbish. It's complicated and I think fascinating. This is a conversation with an interesting soul, not just about food, but about gobbling it up, or if you will, hoovering. Hello there, wonderful ones. This week I'm talking to Christina O'Sullivan, who works for an amazing organisation called Feedback, whose overriding aim is to make our food supply system more sustainable. And I did learn so much. I learnt loads. They're the BBC Appeal Charity of the Week this week. That's how I found out about them. More on that in our conversation. Sorry for the background clicks and stuff. My kid is making Lego next to me. That's the nature of working during homeschooling, so there. The emphasis in this episode is really on avoiding food waste, and one way to do that is to support like a fruit and veg box provider locally who sell the veg that supermarkets end up rejecting for one ludicrous reason or another. I use Oddbox for that reason, so if you're based in or around London and want to give Oddbox a try, I've got a code that gives you a tenner off your first box, which makes it only a few quid. That's either in the podcast notes or in the bio on the podcast's Twitter. So make sure you're following the podcast on Twitter at The Hoovering Pod. It's the same tag on Instagram if you want to follow us there as well. Okay, you join Christina and me on the Zooms, obviously. Already tucking into our respective lunches earlier this very week, both eating up stuff that would have otherwise gone to waste.
It's been so long since I had someone sensible on the podcast.
I hope I just don't disappoint. I'm not sure how sensible I am.
But I don't mean like, I mean, I've had doctors and all sorts, but it's been ages since I've had someone on who knows what they're talking about in terms of, I think, sort of the ethics of eating and the environmental impact of eating and stuff like that. It's been ages. And so it's a fascinating time to get to talk to you. But first of all, I just want to know what you're having for lunch and what it tastes like.
I'm having, I was making like a leek and potato tart, and I had leeks left over. So it's just basically leeks on toast with a poached egg. I feel like you can kind of put anything on toast and it will be good.
Anything on toast is good. With a poached egg on top, did you say? Because that sounds delicious. What's the red bit? Did I see a red bit?
Oh, yeah, it's radicchio. I got it in my veg bag this week. It's like oregano.
Is it quite bitter, that?
It is.
Yeah, so it goes well with like loads of umami leeks and eggs. And
it's
butter.
A kind of, I think some people don't really like it. I do really like it, but yeah, because I guess it's quite bitter, so it divides people a bit.
Do you know what? I've got an, I don't think I like it, but I, do you know, I'm sure I do. I think I had a bad experience where it was in a recipe and I sort of, probably as part of work avoidance, spent an entire day hunting it, all of Southeast London to find one radicchio, and then got it and was like, this is sour.
I had a bit of that the weekend. I was reading this book set in Japan and they were eating a certain type of tofu dish. So I asked my Japanese friend and I needed like kombu, that seaweed, and I couldn't find it in a few shops. And then I was like, it's lockdown, I'm not gonna go to like 10 shops searching for this specific seaweed. I was like, just gonna have to improvise.
Fair play.
Oh, you also have toast, right?
Yeah, I've got toast. I've got a really lovely bakery in Brockley near where I live. It's not even that near actually where I live, but they deliver on a bike.
Oh, that's nice.
It feels a very privileged thing to be able to do. But I was like, well, actually, I might keep that up. They do really nice coffee as well. Little bag of coffee and a loaf of bread every week. Yes, please.
Have you made any like sourdough in lockdown? No,
I have not. Somebody gifted me a sourdough starter on the assumption, not unreasonably, that I'd be the sort of person who would love to make a sourdough at a live one of these podcasts, actually. And I kept it alive in my fridge, but it got to a point where I hadn't made bread for so long, I was worried it would die. So I gave it to someone. I gave it to Tom Selinsky, who produces The Guilty Feminist, and he made delicious bread with it. Mm. Yeah, so it sounds rank, but it is genuinely delicious. I've got a celery soup.
Celery is one of those ones as well, isn't it? Where sometimes I get it and I'm like, oh, but then I have it in a really delicious thing and I'm like, oh, celery. Because I feel like normally I just eat it like as a vehicle for hummus or something.
Yeah,
but then,
totally.
Every so often I cook. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, actually, one of my colleagues, they love celery. So if ever I have too much, I just give, well, in the before times, I just give some to her.
Oh, yeah. I think I associated celery historically with you know, some sort of rank, punitive, restrictive diet. Because there was that myth, wasn't there, that like, negative calories, blah, blah, bollocks. Anyway, I've always liked the taste of it cooked, but I had this fear that I was going to end up with this miserable watery soup. I get a fruit and veg box.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of on theme, actually. It's called Odd Box, and they...
That
supermarkets have rejected or were surplus. And I have had celery in that box every week for a long time. And there's only so much hummus I can enjoy. So I saw that they send a mail out with suggested recipes if you're ending up with a glut of stuff, which is so cool. And so I made this. And I tell you what, I mean, it's delicious because it basically tastes of mashed potato and a really nice stock. But I can really taste the celery in it. And they leave it up to you what herbs to add and stuff, and I like that.
And you can also use whatever you have then as well.
Totally. And I made it last night. I don't know if that works with vegetable soups. It does with stews and stuff, but I feel like it's grown in
I think it does. Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, it's lush with buttery toast. Perfect cold February day.
It's quite grey, isn't it, today? So.
Yeah, I know. We had a bit of sunshine weekend, so I'm not going to move
that. That's true, yeah.
Right. Stop stuffing my face enough to ask you things. You work for Feedback, an organisation which works pretty tirelessly, to make our food system, correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, I've sort of paraphrased, to make our food system more sustainable and less wasteful and become one that's better for the planet. Is that about right?
Yeah.
And this week, and every week presumably, but this week especially, you are raising money because you guys are the BBC Appeal charity this week, raising $20,000 minimum.
Fingers crossed, hopefully.
Yeah, I reckon, I hope it.
We'll will it into existence.
Yes. Yeah. And because your work is so intrinsically linked to all things eating, I want to know about every single possible aspect of it that you're prepared to, talk to me about. But
I'm not sure. We have some pretty niche campaigns where I end up talking about, like, you know, salmon feed. Maybe that's not the most interesting thing.
I think it is so interesting. Oh, I'm a nerd for that stuff. Do you mean like in salmon farms?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really important, isn't it? That stuff's so important because, oh, God, I mean, now I just want to talk about that. but isn't, like, don't you have to feed salmon other fish?
Yeah, exactly. You already, most people don't know that. Yeah, so it's this idea that, like, salmon is super sustainable, but then when you take into account that you still need quite a large proportion of wild fish mm-hmm. for the salmon. Because, yeah, we calculated that it's like 460,000 tons of wild fish just for the Scottish salmon industry. And it was like 460,000 tons, like a kind of random number, but it's basically the equivalent to how much seafood is bought in the UK, but wild and farmed. So it's like quite a lot. And a lot of it is fish that we could eat, like sardines or anchovies.
Really?
I actually have some anchovy paste, which is my like guilty pleasure on my toast as well.
Nice.
Yeah,
salty.
So exactly. Mm. Yeah, so there's so many things. And then I think that's what's so interesting and also sometimes difficult when you talk about these things, that it's so complicated, you know, because it's not just about the salmon. It's like, what does the salmon eat? Where did that come from?
What did that eat? Where did they come from to get that? Is that causing a depletion of something else that would have otherwise been feeding on that? That wasn't a person.
Yeah, exactly.
It goes back and back and back. It's so complicated. But I do think, I don't know, I'm pre-basic bitch when it comes to trying to eat ethically, but I'm normally pescatarian, but I am not being very much at the moment because my fiancé lives with me and she doesn't eat fish. She's completely vegetarian.
Oh, well, that's fair enough.
Yeah, but I mean, on occasion when we get a takeaway, we had pizza the other night and I got one with anchovies because I was like, yes, please. So it's kind of a rare and glorious treat. But anyway, when I am looking for a fish that I can feel less guilty about buying in a normal supermarket or whatever, then I tend to go with the one that's got the marine, the
Stewardship Council one, right?
Yeah, sticker on it. And the salmon's never got it on.
Yeah, I think it's like, so salmon does have some, like some ratings and some labels, but whenever we respond to a consultation, it's because it's off, like, the ratings aren't based, they don't necessarily often take the feed into account, or they do to a certain extent, but not. But I think the problem with salmon is that people just eat so much of it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that thing of once like anything gets too big. Yeah. And I also think, you have this experience, but when I go to supermarkets, like the way they kind of market the salmon to you, it's to make it look like it's wild. And actually you can't buy Scottish wild salmon anymore. The last, production closed down a couple of years ago because there just wasn't enough left.
Wow.
So if you buy Scottish salmon, like it's farmed, but they often, you know, put a picture of like a really beautiful pristine loch on the front. And if, you know, if you turn on the back, it will say somewhere maybe it's farmed, but it's often, it's, you know, it's maybe done to give it this illusion of it's from this beautiful wild place.
Yeah. And it'll be like wearing a kilt and in a particular
I can send you a picture of it because they, they've been exporting it to, like, I think places for sushi, and there's literally one called tartan salmon, and they've got tartan on the pack. Oh. And me and my boss are like, we're looking at it like, oh my God, it's so ridiculous. So yeah, then you're joking, but that's actually, this salmon was, you know, someone played the bagpipes to it.
And then it did a dance upstream, it K-lead up. Yeah,
it's having a great time. So it's wild.
That's part of the work. That's part of the work. I mean, you do so many different things, your organisation, but is to do with like misleading branding and stuff.
Yeah. So we did a campaign, a fun one called Total Bull, which is kind of like that. It's calling out misleading marketing. So we're focusing on that a lot of supermarkets use like fake farm labels. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you buy chicken at Tesco and it's basically like the cheapest, like the value product, but they rebranded it. And so it's called like Willow Farms. So, you know, obviously if you pick that up and you're like a busy person, you're just doing your shop, you know, that's, even if you don't necessarily stop and go, oh, I think this is from a farm, it's to give you this idea that it comes from like a small local farm when the reality is that came from a factory farm. Yeah, exactly.
And isn't there sometimes quite a lot of misleading stuff in terms of the country that things have come from, even if you say like, I mean, I don't think you're allowed to explicitly say.
No, but I think sometimes, I'm not 100%, but like something can come from somewhere, but they could be smoked in Scotland or something. Mm-hmm. And then it might say like, it can be. Yeah, kind of complicated.
Are all the rules around labelling? I know there was quite a lot of quite good EU rules about not being able to say something, you know, was something that it wasn't or had been reared in a way that it wasn't, etc. Are we about to, or have we just lost all of that with Brexit?
I'm not, I think there's definitely, Sustain, who's another charity, they're doing a lot of work on standards and stuff. So I think there is a fear that some of them will be watered down. But I think some of the problems is sometimes as well, like, supermarkets' own standards are stricter. So when it comes to like how a fruit and veg has to look, it's like stricter than say the EU rules or something anyway. So some people want to say, oh, the EU rules are too strict, but the reality is it's like the supermarket actually dictating
how straight a parsnip's got to be, unscuffed an apple's got to be.
And some of it is ludicrous. Like one of my colleagues was telling me once that it wasn't even that. It was like when the four apples were like in the packet, it had to weigh a certain amount.
What?
It's just bonk. Like, it's like, you know, it makes no sense. But
God.
I'm in my tongue.
I really want to know, first of all, because I'm ashamed to say that before I saw your radio appeal, Radio 4, yesterday, I thought that it just meant, like getting enlightening information out of someone. But what is gleaning?
That's definitely a fair assumption.
Okay.
It's a really old practice. It's mentioned in the Bible. So, Jesus endorses that. So it's traditionally people would, if there was surplus left over on farms, local people would go and harvest that, obviously with like permission from the farmer. And I think there's even a term which I quite like, call it like, someone would be like the queen of the glean if they were like the woman running it.
Nice.
So a while ago because we were seeing a lot of food being wasted on farms.
To do with the pandemic or just how inefficient our food systems are?
Yeah, so this would have been pre-pandemic, like we've been gleaning for years now, but for lots of reasons, and a lot of it coming back to like supermarkets having a lot of controls. So the stuff not meeting the right specifications.
Or coming at the wrong time, if the weather changes.
Yeah, exactly. So we had one person say to us once that, say you grow a lot of strawberries because the supermarket says they want this much. And then you send them the strawberries on Monday and they're like, cool, great, fine. And then the weather changes and it's going to rain the next day and people, you know, probably aren't going to eat as much strawberries because they're not having a picnic or whatever. Wow. So then you send them basically the same, like from the same farm, and they're like, oh no, these aren't okay. And because people really rely on having a supermarket contract.
Oh, God.
And also what a lot of farmers say is they have to overproduce because they're like, you never want to like not have enough for a supermarket. So you overproduce by a certain amount to make sure that if there is some weather issue, so your crop doesn't come, or if a supermarket changes their mind. So it's kind of like overproduction is just built into the system in that way. But then you end up at times where, like, say there's a glut of cauliflowers, so there's way too much cauliflowers on the market. And it's sort of like, where do they go then? And the problem, and then where I guess gleaning could be useful, but ultimately needs more systemic changes. The cost of harvesting them is more expensive than what, even if you sold them, say, super cheap, or if you want to donate it to them to a charity, but you still obviously need, if you're a farmer, to pay some labor to harvest them. So that's when stuff like the Gleaning Network can go in and do that.
Well, so what does the Gleaning Network do? Send some volunteers in to pick the stuff?
Yeah, volunteers go to farms.
What's stressful about this is how time sensitive it is.
Exactly. Like,
sometimes it's not going to be until the stuff's rejected.
Yeah, and sometimes it's like the farmer's like, can you come tomorrow or something? Yeah, it obviously depends on the veg, but yeah, it can be. And it can also be like, I've been on gleans where, say, like, there's so much apples and you do your best, but like at the end of the day, you know, there's going to be so much still go to waste, but you're like, that's just, you know, the reality. Yeah. But it's strange because you can see it and you're like, it's all really good, and you can like eat them. You're like, they taste really good. But you kind of can't harvest it all because there's too much.
God, it's bonkers. It is bonkers. I wanted to ask about some of the stuff that you have gleaned. And I don't know, I mean, we were talking in advance of this about things that get, I think veg that gets a bad rep that you can, that you can end up, that you've ended up having like loads of, I mean, apples, I feel like apples, especially in the UK, we have an abundance of,
just we get a lot at the same time, right? And then people are like, too many apples.
Yeah, I mean, there are endless things to do with apples. Whereas, I don't know, what was the one you brought up in advance of this?
Cabbage. Well, cabbage is one that in my colleagues, like, who are based in Liverpool and Manchester, so they always, they get a lot. They're like, we're gleaning kale again. They get a lot of cabbage. I get a lot of cabbage in my veg bag as well the last couple of months. So I've definitely been feeling, experiencing that. And then pumpkins is one we often end up with a lot of as well, because a lot of pumpkins, they get grown for Halloween and then they're not
you can eat them, I think.
Exactly, yeah. So we have started now, because we are getting so many pumpkins and because also they can be difficult to prepare in terms of, you know, like peeling the skin. So we've started a social enterprise, basically, that's turning those into soup.
Oh wow!
That we will sell. It's it's called Sussex Surplus, and it's also to provide like kind of meaningful paid entry level jobs, because there isn't that many. So we have like people all on living wage contracts working on the soup, and like they'll actually, you know, learn different skills and they have a new kitchen, and so it's exciting as well. So that taking something, we've done other stuff as well, like pumpkin gnocchi, which is apparently very nice. But yeah, they've gone with soup as the first product.
How amazing. That's very cool.
Yeah, we're really excited. It's been a bit delayed because of COVID and Brexit, but I think the soup will be like ready very soon. So that's really exciting.
Excellent. I don't think people, I think lots of people don't realise how long you can, all kale and stuff. I just freeze it.
Or like that, I said it last, because if you buy often, you know, a bag of kale in the supermarket, it will have a best before date on it, which fresh produce doesn't need to have. And it kind of can create this sense in your brain of, oh, that won't be good, I can't eat that afterwards. But like, but you can, and something like a pumpkin will last, if you, especially if it hasn't been cut into, will last a really long time.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, in a cold, dark place. Pumpkins, I feel like, live really, really extraordinarily long time. Yeah. Even like hard cabbages, that's what I've got loads of at the moment. And I'm not running out of ideas, because I feel like I've got kind of got no excuse at the moment in the age of the internet.
Yeah.
Like
Do you mean like a hard white cabbage?
Yeah,
or
not like a wrinkly Savoy, a hard white cabbage. Kimchi.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Because my housemate was going to try kimchi. Was it good?
It's fiddly to make, and I had to buy Kilner jars, but now I've got Kilner jars forever.
We have a couple of Kilner jars, so.
Yeah, so, and then it's not that fiddly. I mean, it's not expensive. You need, I needed salt, chilli flakes. You know, you can go all out and get special Korean spice mixes, or you can just make your own chili flake mixture up. And then you need bottled water, or sterilised water, I should say.
So you could like boil it and let it cool or something.
Well, you just got to make the jars ultra clean, and you've got to wash it all, and you've got to salt it all, and you've got to rinse it all. And then you've got to, it's just got to be, there can't be any bacteria in there when you put it all in there. And then it's just like a waiting game. And then, I don't know, it could have been beginner's luck, but it was really nice, the one I made.
Yeah, because I tried one recently, but it was a bit off. I got this new cookbook called Vegetable Kingdom. It's like a vegan cookbook by someone called Brian Terry, and they had a kohlrabi one. I've been getting a lot of kohlrabi in my veg bag, but then I kind of went rogue and put all this kale in it, and then it kind of didn't work as well. But I ended up mixing it with tofu and making like dumplings out of it for Lunar New Year. That was actually really good. But I think I was like, maybe we should try cabbage next time.
Is kohlrabi the big like enormous white radish?
It almost looks like an apple. It is like an orb, but it does have like big leaves coming out of it. So I think the first time you see it, you're probably like, what is that?
I'm getting it confused, I think, with,
I think you're thinking of a daikon.
Yes, maybe. A daikon. You'll know.
I don't know if I've said it right.
But yeah, I think just never-ending coleslaw. We're a coleslaw factory.
Yeah,
luckily, my 5-year-old will devour coleslaw.
Yeah, even if I made for pancake day last week, like, you know, those savory kind of, they're kind of like Japanese pancakes, like okonomiyaki, and it's like you just shred the cabbage and put it in.
Yeah.
And that was because my housemate was like, did you get cabbage in your veg bag again? And I was like, yes, but I swear it's actually delicious.
I know what, I've still got more things to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm putting it in a Japanese omelette. Yeah. Watch this.
Yeah, it was my plan all along.
Japanese pancakes.
the souffle ones or as well. I tried to make them yesterday and my whisker stopped working while I was beating the white eggs, the egg whites. And then I was like, will I do this by hand? And then I was like, no, I'm just
I won't do it by hand.
I just use some days you get those vibes. You're like, this isn't going to work. Yeah. I'm going to let it go.
Delicious.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Please may you tell me, what is nutrient recycling?
Oh, do you mean in terms of, like, it's basically keeping good food, I suppose, in the food system.
Right.
So we also have a work on, like I was mentioning, kind of animal feed earlier in terms of salmon feed. But I don't think too many people know sometimes that when you hear a lot that say like livestock, like meat is really bad for climate change. And a lot of that comes from the feed as well. Because, you know, like, soy and so like chicken and beef, like there can be fed a lot of soy, so then it makes it like a much bigger environmental footprint. So there, like historically we would have fed a lot of food waste to pigs, because pigs are, that's actually kind of why pigs evolved, because they could eat like human food waste.
Pigs.
Yeah, and then
I'm like a pig.
Yeah, exactly.
I was born in the Chinese year as a pig, and I remember sort of hearing that. I think probably as quite a sensitive teenager and being like, oh, God, and then reading about it, and it was like quite intelligent but very greedy, and I was like, oh, I'll take it.
Yeah, it's not the worst one.
So
the nutrient recycling then would be keeping certain food when there's, say, too much of it, or turning it into feed that could go to animal feed. So a certain amount of that is done at the moment, but because the laws are quite strict, it kind of means that there's a lot that could go to that feed that isn't. And it just means that, yeah, the ideal, I guess, for us would be, at the moment, it's like you have a kind of linear food supply chain with a lot of food waste, whereas the goal would have a more circular one where ultimately very little food is wasted. So, you know, if there was because things happen in nature and things happen in life, or you might have a surplus of something that would either figure out a way, like maybe like we're talking about making soup or making kimchi, also that sometimes that could be turned into animal feed in certain situations that might be the best use for it. So it's like keeping as much of the food we grow basically in the food supply chain.
Oh God, it's so interesting. And then you have this thing called the supermarket scorecard. And is that to do with how, and is that ever changing, or was that a study that was done at one point in time recently about which supermarkets are the best and the worst at wastefulness when it comes to their food buying and selling?
We have done a few supermarket scorecards. So the first one we did, yes, was on food waste. I did that one, so I can talk on it quite well. Yeah, I think, and then since then we have done one on fish, so on aquaculture and also on meat, and we're about to redo the one on meat. The one on food waste basically was, it was to kind of highlight that a lot of supermarkets now, compared to when we were first working on this issue, say they do stuff on food waste. But I guess it was to try disentangle, like, or highlight, like, what are you actually taking meaningful action? Because it's all fine and well to have a, we now sell wonky avocados, but like, what's, like, are you measuring it? Is it working? So it was to kind
it's amazing, really, because I mean, a lot of the time I think it's to do with which supermarket's got the best PR. Ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's an element to that.
Yeah, how widely spreading. And I know your audience. Do you know what I mean? I was so surprised at the worst supermarket in that report for wastefulness at the time, which was Waitrose.
Yeah.
Because my lovely uncle, who actually did the music for this podcast, but he's like, he loves his Waitrose and he can be a little bit, dare I say it? I don't know. Like, he's a bit like, oh, you still get stuff from Amazon. And his argument was, oh, Waitrose are amazing because they get food that's travelled less, like less very long distance imported food compared to, and the example he was given was Aldi, Lidl. Like, you know, he was like, that's, they're getting, you know, they're better environmentalists. And then it's like, me, Mike.
yeah, I think they did better on the meat one. But yeah, right, for some of the food waste stuff. And then it's interesting because I remember some of the stuff they're saying. But then I, like, one of the days around it, because obviously they were like unhappy with coming last, I saw like a Waitrose van and it had like a woman holding apples. It was like, we only choose the best apples. And I was like,
yeah, that's the problem. You snob.
Waitrose.
Yeah. I can't admit, I'm in love. I love all supermarkets, but I do wish they'd all up their game. And in that report, Tesco's did the best. Yeah. Although, obviously, at the same time, they're pretending that their most massacred animal meat is coming from a cute little farm.
And, you know, we will often say, because a lot of stuff, when you talk about food waste, you know, a lot of responsibility gets put on the individuals. You know, we all need to stop wasting food. And like, on one level, yes, but also, you know, supermarkets make more money when we buy food we don't need.
And yeah, I'll feel like a bit of supply and demand. Because Hugh Fernie Whittington did a documentary, didn't he? Which I think was like, certainly in terms of like mass realization about what was going on. And it was Morrison's and Parsnips, wasn't it? And it was heartbreaking to watch all this stuff being rejected. But the supermarket's defense at the time was, people will not buy the wonky ones. The consumer has been trained to expect, you know, and you've got that stereotypical idea of people squeezing everything, check what's perfect. Like we did in the, like when we were all shopping in a grocer's or whatever. I don't know. It just seems to be a case of putting maximum pressure on for real transparency. I think what you're doing is so important because as much as I think there's quite that sort of a white liberal middle class argument of like, well, just shop at the greengrocers then. Or just get a veg shop. You know, get a sustainable organic veg box. And you're like, not everyone can do that. And there's too many people in the population. It's hugely expensive to live like that. I mean, fine, if you can, do. But ultimately, we do also, we've got to change the practice in supermarkets because that's always going to be a necessary place. And it is so convenient to be able to go to one place and get everything.
Because like you look at how much power the supermarkets have, like, you know, it's like there's 10 big supermarkets. The top four control so much of the market share. Pretty much all of us shop in a supermarket at some stage during the week. So it's pretty naive of them, I think, to say that they don't influence how we buy food,
especially
over
the course
food.
Of the last year, when essentially they've been the equivalent of a theme park because they were the only place.
Exactly. So I think supermarkets definitely have a job to do in terms of like both the waste in their own supply chain, but also in ensuring that their customers don't waste that much. And we have asked supermarkets, you know, would you do a study to see like if people are wasting less at home from your shop? None have done that. Or would you, for instance, as a metric of success, like say that we should be selling less like less sales would suggest less waste. And I think if you say less sales to anyone working in a corporation, no, they're like, they're brave, but they're like, no, because that's not how it works, because people buy higher value stuff. But it's this kind of idea of like, what, you know, ultimately we do need, you need to be selling less and you need to be selling different stuff. So, you know, I like, it's a long time ago now, but I remember to do with gleaning, like talking to farmers where cauliflowers, there's a big cauliflower glut and loads of cauliflowers going to waste. And it was the same around the same time that like courgette crisis was happening, where they were like, there was not enough courgettes. And it was like, well, like there's loads of cauliflowers. So you could be, you know, marketing cauliflowers to people. But it's this, yeah, this weird kind of like myth of we have to have every single thing. And
But we've got, again, I guess they've led it and people have gone along with it. We are so used to having access to all the things all the time, out of season. You know, and actually, you know, considering there's a pandemic and Brexit food things have got off to quite a rocky start in some ways, it's pretty impressive, actually, that the only things that have really, I mean... I don't know, maybe it isn't. I know that seafood industry has had a terrible time. But other than that, and I say this only because I did a news quiz the week that that was all kicking off, so I feel like I read everything that week. But it did look like it was kind of quite luxury items like biscuits and scotch and shit like that that wasn't making its way to Brussels and France.
Yeah.
And like, no offence, but who cares?
It's probably all right.
Sorry, M&S. But yeah, it does boggle me that there's then no room for that flexibility, because that mindset has gone of like, well, what, of course you wouldn't have strawberry in December.
It's also that like, the way the system works, it's kind of like a just-in-time system, which, you know, was created for car manufacturing, which makes sense if you're manufacturing a car, but is not, doesn't really, you can't necessarily apply it to like the
Is that why the system got so fucked by lockdown one? When people,
because it was so reliant on these like very little, you know, like you want very little stuff stored for a long period of time. It's constantly moving stuff, maximizing your square foot space, but then it's not resilient, and it's not resilient to shocks in the food system. And I think that's why a lot of like smaller like community like veg boxes and stuff were okay, because they had built kind of in some, they were able to survive those things in the way the supermarket model isn't really.
Yeah. Oh, God, it's so interesting. And so, yeah, I suppose they all are going to want to be at the top of your scorecards. We just have to keep putting that sort of pressure on supermarkets, I guess, and try and sort of turn the tides. Because, as you say, like, I think that putting the pressure on the individual, I mean, fair dues, like, I think there are different types of attitude toward, like, even within households about, like, who'll eat stuff that, you know, it's so interesting. I love the idea that we shouldn't have best before dates on fruit and vegetables. It's pretty obvious if it's edible or not. And also there's certain fruit and veg that sort of the chemical composition of it changes as it ages, but it doesn't mean it's useless.
Yeah, banana, so that's the thing, like, it might taste slightly different.
Yeah, but bananas get sweeter. They're great if you chop them up, peel them, chop them up, freeze them, stick it in a smoothie, bush bash bosh. Same with like lots of greens. I think you can freeze this. There's hardly any, if you're prepared to whiz it up into either a soup or smoothie or something, there's hardly anything you can't freeze. But what I mean is, yeah, it doesn't fully make sense to put all that pressure on the individual. Ultimately, as you said, like when you're gleaning apples and you've eaten one, maybe two, like you can't, you can't like get through it. You can't just keep getting through it. One person, because then I suppose ultimately it feels, once you're making yourself feel sick, it's also another kind of waste. But
And also what you mentioned earlier, you know, it's like, a lot of people will say, oh, you know, but we could all choose to not shop at supermarkets but like the reality is not everyone has that choice. No. You know, some people live places where there isn't even that many places where they can buy food, let alone fresh food.
There's even going to be people who live in a remote place where it's only one of those four big supermarkets that will deliver to them who are shielding. You know, there's so many sort of blasé assumptions made, I think, by my ilk, you know, Guardian reading etc., that people are all kind of like just making poor choices, or they're just not educated. You know, people just don't know how to cook, and that's why. And it's like, no, like, they don't understand nutrition. You're like, well, I think that's bullshit, actually. I think you've just got that choice, you know.
And it's even like having time to cook. Like I said, like, you can make kimchi, but you need time. You need to be able to afford Kilner jars. And if you're on like a 0-hour contract, how do you plan how you're going to cook for the week?
Or
what you're
going to,
like,
I mean,
it's just totally ludicrous.
4 years ago, I'd never heard of kimchi, and I'm definitely middle class. Come on. I mean, like, it's the sort of thing that my mum would be like, you know, call it Kwam Chai for the next 6 years and then probably try it then. How are some of the things, because again, I found your website revelatory, and I would say to anybody listening to this who's like, I haven't got any money to donate to this appeal, just read about what these guys are up to, because it's extraordinary. And actually the breadth of all the things you're investigating and the studies you're doing and things you're campaigning about is incredible. And I felt, just from, you know, a half hour read of the website this morning, really enlightened. I want to know about how some of the things we are growing in the UK are harming the planet, even in the soil, I read. And I think, because I think there's sort of a growing knowledge that, as you were saying before, like, it's a misconception to think that all the soy that's being grown is to feed vegans.
it's to feed animals.
So, but there are other things. Sugar?
Yeah, that's quite a new, and I didn't know much about sugar beforehand. It was that, like, I think when we all think of sugar, we're kind of used to getting this health messaging, you know, like, sugar is bad for us, it's rotting our teeth, whatever. But that quite a lot of sugar beet is grown in the UK. And not only that, but it's grown in like the prime agricultural soil. So it's sort of like we're using this really good soil where we could be growing fruit and vegetables to grow sugar beet to make sugar, which we, you know, you need a certain amount of sugar. Like, I made marmalade recently and used quite a lot. So it's not that we shouldn't be making
it. I don't want to rude. I don't believe in the moral good or badness of food. No. It can have different nutritional value, fine. But, like, I don't have an issue with sugar per se. Yes, please, to sugar.
Yeah,
generally.
But it's like, should
but
we
I,
be
I had no
using...
idea that what it was doing was having a negative impact then on the quality of the soil and using up space that we could have had other.
Exactly. It's like, should we be using as much land and the good quality soil that we are to grow sugar is another question. And then it's similarly like growing energy crops. So growing food basically to feed to like anaerobic digesters to make soy is like, is that, that's not the best use of, it's sort of weird that sometimes I find myself in a situation where it's almost like controversial to be like, we should be growing food for people to eat. Like, and everyone's like, shut up. You know, like,
what?
You know, you find yourself every so often being like, this. And obviously, as like, things are way more complicated, things are complicated, but on lots of levels, it's like, what, when you take a step back, it's like, why are we growing, you know, lots of things to make energy when we could be growing that to make, to grow
I mean,
more
it's
vegetables.
It's a simple
or...
answer, because that's where the easiest dollar is. Like,
yeah, I think sometimes it's that. And I think sometimes it's also just people get, you know, stuck in this the way we've always done it. You know, so we grow sugar here, that.
and farmers
need help with transitioning to other things, because it shouldn't be a massive cost, like, or a burden on the farmer to transition to a more sustainable thing either. Because, yeah, we have a kind of, I guess, a principle that guides that work, which is it should be like the maximum nutritional output for the minimal environmental damage. So that should kind of be a guiding principle in how we go about growing food. And even stuff, I don't know if you've come across Hadmedads, they grow pulses in the UK. They're really good. So they grow like, and a lot of them are kind of varieties, maybe like different types of beans that apparently we had here a long time ago. And they were just saying that, you know, you actually can grow that stuff here, and people just hadn't been like,
Hadmedads. Cool. Oh, it's so interesting.
I feel like such a, like, oh, I love lentils.
I love lentils. In the right place or time.
I do love lentils.
I challenge anybody who thinks they don't like lentils to not like a really sexy tarka dal. I think that's could sway around. Or a black dal, any dal, just a good dal. I should just say just a good dal. I think that's like, it's like, Oh, I mean, it's just joyful. It's just so joyful.
I've been eating a lot of lentils this lot. I think, you know, it's like a thing in Italy. I think they cook them on New Year's Eve. It's supposed to be like lucky. So I saw Rachel Roddy. I don't know if you know that chef. I love her. And she was doing it. So I just got into the thing of making them all the time. And I'm going to make a shepherd's pie with these. I'm going to put them on toast.
Lush. Yeah, I think I've got like, I think because a couple of years ago, I had a go at complete veganism and, well, I never was going to be absolute. And then actually I sort of, it was enjoying it and stuff, but I just went overboard. I went overboard on the whole lentils and things. And I think there's such a stereotype about like that kind of fusty whole food slops, which is, to be fair, I mean, there still are places where you can go and get like lentils eight ways with some kind of like boiled potato next to it. You can almost smell the hemp even just talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's when you make it into a really good ragu or a really good dal, then yes, I'm all over it.
Yeah.
I just, perhaps more sparingly these days. How did you end up doing this job for this company? How did you end up with this? Haven't you got a degree in, you did food policy or something?
Yeah, I guess I've always been interested in food kind of since I was a teenager. But I think when I was younger, I thought that like a career in food meant like being a chef or being a farmer.
Yeah.
I didn't really think much beyond that. And I actually just did like psychology in university because I think I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Fair enough.
But when I was finishing, I got like asked to apply for like a scholarship and they were like, what are you going to do afterwards? And I was like, I don't know. So I kind of was like, I'm interested in food. So I Googled like food psychology and turns out that was kind of a thing. So I said I was going to do that. And then I did an internship at Cornell University of America at like a kind of place specializing in kind of food psychology, is looking at how the environment you're in impacts how you eat or what you eat. And I guess I just realized that I was more interested really in food than anything else. So then I did this master's in food policy, which is at City University in London. And then I worked on the BBC food website for a couple of years.
Right.
Doing like different recipe testing and writing things about food. And and then I had volunteered for Feedback before then. And so then I've been working there for 4 years now. So
amazing. Yeah. Oh God, it feels like the path not taken, mate, if I'm honest. I also love food instead. I have a podcast about eating.
Yeah, like it's funny, isn't it? Because like I was such a nerd. I really liked maths when I was younger and I was going to do that at university and I obviously didn't. And then when I worked on BBC Food, one of my colleagues had done maths at Oxford and I was like, maybe you end up doing different things.
I really loved history at school, like so much. And I did for like philosophy, religion and ethics and history A-levels. And I loved those two of them so much. But I thought, I can't do a degree in one of those because I'll just sort of float about then and won't get a job. So I did law and then finished that and then just never was a lawyer and floated about and did all that. And I do look back now. We should have just done the subject you had to fire.
Exactly. Because that's what I keep saying, I'm like, it actually doesn't really matter what you do your undergrad. Like, you know, you can do anything else really afterwards.
16, which is when you start applying, has got
exactly. You just don't know
what they want to do or what they're interested in. Okay, I'm going to ask you some non-work related things to do with eating. Is there any food that you hate that everybody else loves, or a food that you love that everybody else hates? People are a bit sort of marmitey about anchovies, aren't they? So I'm glad.
I do love them. Yes. That's one. Yeah, as I said, my housemate introduced me to, I don't know if you have it, it's anchovy. It's like basically like a thing of toothpaste. Looks like toothpaste, but it's anchovy paste, and like it's so good to put it on kind of anything, really.
Is it just super salty, super fishy, super salty?
Basically, oily. Yeah, it's like super umami. It's really good. I really hate creme caramel. Ooh. I don't know what it is. It's like the texture of it. I can't, I even thinking about it now, I'm like, and I remember being on a French exchange.
What do you mean
and
they creme caramel? Like a creme brulee?
You like the dessert. Not a creme brulee, like the kind of more jelly one.
Yeah, it's like a jelly. It's like set and it's got like a brown caramelly sort of liquid, cold.
I was on a French exchange when I was younger once and they gave it for dessert and I felt like I couldn't be rude and not eat it. But I remember like, you try to eat something without tasting it. So I was like, I'd take a spoon and kind of go like, I'm not a fan. So I think similarly, I don't love jelly.
How old
jelly,
were you when you went on your French exchange?
Yeah, I was like 16. Oh. So I was, you know.
I was 13 when I went on mine. And my friend was with a family who on their first night, as an exciting adventure, took them out to a local abattoir.
What?
Watch some chickens get murdered. I had a thing happen where my family were really lovely that I was staying with, but they were like, you know, feeders, love through food, and I love to eat, so they loved that. And they were like, have some more, have some more, have some more. My French was still like rubbish. So I was 13, and I said, non merci, je suis pleine, which I thought meant literally I am full. Yes. Yeah, I told them I was pregnant.
Yeah, someone said that on our. On ours is when our French teacher was like, that doesn't mean what you think it means. So she, and you'd say like, j'en ai assez or something. I was like, I've had enough.
I think you say, trop mangé. I have too much eat.
She was like, don't say, because it happened to someone else.
Right.
I think the other one is someone said something like about preservatives or something, which I think is condom. You know, they were like,
this lasts forever. No. This means, pop a Johnny on.
Doesn't mean what you think it means.
Creme caramel, though. Yeah, okay, fair enough. And there's nothing worse than staying with a family. It's not even like a hotel or something. It's like, God, you've got to just get it down.
I've
always been suspicious of anything that's like a jelly consistency.
Yeah, it's something about that texture. Because other than that, I think liquid. I don't really eat meat, more for environmental reasons. But I think I pretty much I'll try kind of everything.
Amazing.
So, and quite enjoy eat. Because even this chat at work once, it was like, what was the strangest thing you've ever eaten? And people said different things. And I was like, I've had rat once. And I was like, sorry, what? And I was like at an art event with my friend in Dublin. And it was called like a scarcity banquet. So the idea was like food you might eat in the apocalypse or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
and
so we
crickets,
had
locusts.
Yeah, we did. We had some insects. We had rat. And
rat. Fuck. That's like Blackadder.
Nice. It tasted kind of like chicken. Like it was kind of just like char grilled. It was nice. But we also had, which was the most disgusting thing, was. You might not want to put this in the podcast.
I do want to, but first of all, can I just say, why is it whenever anyone's eaten something fucking weird that it always tastes like chicken?
It tastes like chicken, it's
from
just
crocodile through to rat, it turns out everything tastes like chicken. You're almost about to make you think, should we just give chickens a break? literally.
Yeah, we ate... I think the idea was that also like this bring up a conversation about cannibalism. Made this food look like body parts, and it looked like mine looked like a dead baby's foot. And I said this at the work table, and they were like, what are you talking about? And I have a picture of it, and I sent them the picture, and they were like, I cannot, this is crazy. So they were like, I'm never asking you this question again. Like, what's the weirdest thing?
Oh my God. But what have they made it out of?
I'm not even sure, to be honest. But for me, what's worse is I feel like if something smells really bad, I find that hard. And it smelled like they made it smell really bad. So I had to kind of like eat it. Like, I can send you the picture if you want.
No, thanks. No, I'm all right. Thank you. that was quite firm from me, wasn't it? No, I'm squeamish about children and baby stuff. I read that book, The Road, and... and was scarred by it. Also, I find myself, like, I often ask the question, and maybe I'll ask you it now then, but like, if there was no other option, would you ever eat a person? But, and I often say, do you know what, probably if I was starving, but I do have like a really forceful, involuntary, internal, massive repulsion dial up. The only films that like, I have had recurring nightmares about other ones that I've seen that have involved cannibalism, even when they have done it in quite a kind of farcical way. I'll remember scenes in detail, and I don't really remember anything that I see films wise. So there must be something about it that gets me. But anyway, would you literally, I just threw my pen at the wall. Literally no other option. Would you eat a person?
I mean, it's hard to know because I've obviously never been in that situation. I think I probably would, because there's that example of the plane crash, isn't there?
Where
they ended up eating the people. And I think I probably would. I'd probably gnaw on someone's someone's leg or something.
Love it. I love
I'd like
it
to think I'm above it, specific. But I feel like, yeah, if I was faced with with death, I would probably do it.
Fair enough. Hangover, what are you having?
Ooh. So in my pre-not being vegetarian ways, I don't know if you've ever had it. It's a thing in Ireland. It's called a hot chicken roll. So like,
talk to me about it.
Basically like a kind of fairly standard, like say cuisine de France, but not like fancy sourdough bread or anything. And then like most definitely factory farm chicken that's caught and like in breadcrumbs.
Right.
In the roll, and then you can obviously add what you want, but like it's just, I don't know what it is. I think it's because like the hot chicken kind of melds into the roll.
Whoa, but it's like a soft roll, and it also
it's like a long one, kind of more nice. You know, and then and people get quite, because I said I put, when I used to get them, I used to put like cheese and jalapenos, and then some of my friends were like, you can't put jalapenos, that's stupid. So people get quite like defensive for what they put in.
Okay.
And I think there's even a place in Dublin doing vegan hot chicken rolls now, which I haven't had, so that would have been my kind of go-to. So now I guess it's like similar. I would definitely want something, I never want something sweet, I want something like salty and carby, so like a lot of toast or something like that. Like I definitely, you know, some people seem to crave sweet things, but I want like a lot of carbs more so, I think.
Yeah, me too, generally, although I do find it depends on the hangover. Sometimes,
yeah,
sometimes I need a spicy thing. And then
yeah, I remember once, I think I was actually going to one of the climate markets in London, and I was super hungover, and I was in like the Sainsbury's in Tottenham Court Road, and I was like, I need a can of Coke or I'm gonna die.
Yeah,
and I couldn't find it for ages, and I almost had to like lie on the someone get me Coke. I really need one. And it's funny because I normally don't drink Coke and stuff, but yeah, sometimes when you're hungover, you're like, no, this is the specific thing I need right now.
It's so true. I'm not really a sweet tooth at all, but then I've got a distinct memory of a hangover where I was like, it needs to be Galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're in that hungover space, it's like you focus on it so much. But I think the worst hungovers I've had, ones hangovers where like I couldn't eat anything. I had like upset.
It's been a long time, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
I remember once on New Year's Day, a long time ago, I was still living with my parents, and my parents do a kind of like almost similar to Christmas dinner on New Year's Day. They do like a roast as well.
Yeah.
And so my dad was like, try this. And I ate it and I like, got sick. And like they invited my grandparents over and I just couldn't eat. Like I had like one potato at dinner and my grandmother was like, you should take a picture of that, Christina, to remind you to not overindulge in future. But I just like, I couldn't eat anything. I was so, so I think that's worse. If you can actually eat, at least you can kind of indulge yourself in eating.
Yeah, totally. Like, nice and heal yourself. Doors turn sentient and go on strike. It's absolutely rubbish. Everyone looks like burglars climbing in and out of windows or chimneys, and loads of people are just trapped indoors, getting thirstier and hungrier and even more bored. And obviously, wall smashing down takes ages. And after all the staying in we're doing anyway, you can imagine it is a hellscape. It's awful. Loads of people are trapped in like cells, and it's increasingly urgent. Luckily, the Doors have agreed to go back to work. Only if you, though, and weirdly, it does have to be you, actually, Christina, agree to have 981 goes on a zip wire with a muddy lake puddle underneath it, one after another, with absolutely no breaks. It sounds impossible, but you do it! You're a hero. You reward as a place in history as the woman who saved us all from doorlessness. But your reward in the moment is a feast of your dreams. It's a fantasy feast, so I don't care about the consequences of any of this food. This isn't all the ethics chat we've had goes out the window, I think, for this. Consequences, etc., etc.
I want 10 pigs on a spit. I don't know.
It's like, I've got baby's foot again. Yeah. but yeah, it's, anything is an option. There's no right or wrong answer. I should also add, I understand this is your answer right now, and if I asked you after a different question or in 10 minutes time, it could be different. You're the happiest and hungriest it's possible to be. It's not like a last meal. It's like the opposite in terms of emotionally and physically. Sort of where your head's at. What would you have?
So I feel like in some ways I'm quite basic. I would want like really good fresh bread with like lots of butter and like sea salt on the butter. And then like really nice maybe pasta if I was really hungry. So, but even like a simple one like cacio e pepe, or the one like olio aglio with like this parsley and garlic and with like lots of oil. So I wouldn't be stressed about like, is this enough Parmesan? I'd be like, put as much on as you want.
Yeah.
And I guess what would be nice in that, if there was no limits, is, I mean, this sounds awful since we've been talking about waste, but do you ever sometimes like you're eating something and it's so good and you want to keep eating and you're like, oh, I can see why they had a vomitorium back in the Roman days.
Yeah. So you can start again.
Yeah, but I don't want a vomitorium, but I just want to be able to eat as much, like,
I hear what you're saying, full experience. Yeah, you don't want to get full. No, that can be hard.
I want to be able to eat as much pasta.
Do you know a number of guests on this podcast say that? It's like, I've got too many things I want to eat.
Yeah.
So part of the fantasy has to be not getting full and or not feeling satisfied, but, you know, not discomfort, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be like, ugh. And the other thing is,
you know, you can take days over this if you want. You can go and go away, come back, go away, come
back,
and
everything will be perfect. It's like an ever-refilling pasta bowl.
Yeah. Oh, God, it sounds delish. Would you have anything particular to drink with it?
I mean, probably just some nice wine. I don't know loads about wine, but just a nice, not a carton of wine from Tesco, maybe something.
What wine that's so posh it's come in a glass bottle?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. That's all I want.
Lockdown's really changed this, hasn't it?
Someone to serve it to me that isn't one of my housemates.
Yeah. And they ask you what you'd like, and then you have a cuddle, and then they get you what you like, and then you have a cuddle, and then, oh my God, I can't wait to do cuddling again. Say scrumdiddlyumptious. And then you can be in my podcast. What a lovely and fascinating guest. Thanks loads to Christina. First things first, please donate to their appeal. They're aiming to raise 20 grand, as I said in the podcast, for their future projects. And you could really help, even with a small, small amount. If you can, do. Go to feedbackglobal.org. Or follow them on social media where there's links to all of their stuff. I've tweeted about them. They're on Twitter as @feedback.org and the same on Instagram. And also, if you search for that on Facebook, you'll find they're on there as well. All of that, as including everything else that we mentioned that's interesting in the podcast, is all as ever in the podcast notes. If you want to follow Christina's personal socials, she's on Twitter as @ChrisShineA, one word, ChrisShineA, and Instagram Chris_Shine_A. Again, all of that's in the podcast notes. If you're like, do you know what? I haven't got any money. Still read their website. It's just so, I just learned stuff. I felt like I was getting a foundation degree in sustainable food systems, because the breadth of stuff they do is extraordinary. If you would like a fruit and veg box that uses and gives you the wonky stuff that is never very wonky, to be honest, or scuffed, ever so slightly marked, they call it, so supermarkets reject it. It's so mad. I know that there must be others all around the rest of the UK or wherever you're listening. It's just search. If you're in London, I know Oddbox are an option, and I have a code that gives you a tenner off your first one if you fancy that. It's in the podcast notes and or in the bio on the podcast Twitter at The Hoovering Pod. Make sure you're following the podcast on Twitter and on Instagram. Feel free to support this podcast with lovely reviews, recommendations. Subscribing to the podcast helps other people find it. Please tell other people about the podcast. If you want to support us with actual money, you can give a one-off amount over on Acast Supporter, or you can become a regular podcast helper on Patreon, where you give a few quid a month in exchange for brilliant podcast-related stuff, including completely exclusive content. That looks amazing, Roots. Well done. That is brilliant. Sorry, the Lego continues. It's a Harry Potter's train station platform, Hogwarts Express platform 9 3/4. I'll help you with that bit, maybe, love, in a sec. Give me a sec. I'm just going to finish this, Roots. Give me a sec.
I don't know how to do this.
Okay, I mean, this is the least professional in and out I've ever done, with Lego clinking in the background. But I mean, I'm mildly enjoying it. I hope you are too. Follow me on social media if you like, @JessicaFosterQ. Anything longer than a tweet to send me, you can email me through my website, jessicafosterq.com. Huge thanks to Acast for hosting the podcast. Hoovering is produced by Emma Corsham, and the music is by Mike Greenway. Until next week, happy hoovering. Also, special thanks to Rudy for putting up with me working when we're supposed to be doing some very important Lego.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too.
That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.